Thank you for downloading this podcast from Talk Radio 702 and 567 Cape Talk. For more podcasts and more information on your number one news and talk station, please visit 702.co.za or capetalk.co.za.
Reedy DiRecco.
It is 17 minutes past 11 o'clock. Now, today's discussion is a philosophical one, and the question we're exploring, are our lives much worse than we think? Professor David Benatar's book, Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence, is not exactly what you may describe as pro-life. It can be said that his take on life leans towards nihilism. The title sums it up. It would be better never to have been. Not just for people born into extreme poverty or violence or disability, though such claims would be controversial enough, but better for everyone never to have been. And we mean everyone. David Benatar shows that there are a number of well-documented features of human psychology that explain why people overestimate the quality of their lives and why they are thus resistant to the suggestion that they are seriously harmed by being brought into existence. Just very briefly, the book argues that all our lives are very bad and generally much worse than we think. So we are systematically and significantly mistaken about their value. We shouldn't have children. Women should have early abortions. The abortion debate on the whole is between the pro-life and the pro-choice lobbies. The professor holds a candle for the pro-death view. He thinks that any woman needs excellent reasons not to abort her child. He hopes that one day all humans and all other animals will be extinct. He does make a distinction between coming into and continuing to exist. It's better not to come into existence, but once we are around, we might as well have some fun, since suicide is an unpleasant business. These are startling claims, I admit. They are straightforward, I believe, and it makes you question life. Although the good things in one's life might make it go better than it otherwise would have gone, one could have been deprived by their absence if one had not existed. You know what I mean? So all the positive experiences we use to justify our lives, to argue that it's better to be alive than not to be alive at all. Those who never exist cannot be deprived. So if you've... Love it. Those who never exist cannot feel pain, you can't feel joy, you can't feel anything. However, by coming into existence, one does suffer some serious harms that could not have befallen one had one not come into existence. Does that make sense? Makes sense to me. The professor joins us in the studio. A very good morning to you, Professor. And of course, he's the head of philosophy department at the University of Cape Town. Good morning, Prof.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. I love being alive. What are you telling me?
Well, once you're alive, if you're enjoying it, then continue. That's great. But had you not been here, there would be nobody to have missed what you're enjoying.
Oh, come on. So there would have been nobody to have the good and the bad experiences of life. So how do we conclude then you're better off not having come into existence? I wouldn't have experienced some of the pleasures that I've experienced. So I'm better off having experienced them.
Well, look at what you've just said. You said you wouldn't have experienced the pleasures, but you wouldn't have been. And so there would have been nobody who would have been deprived of your pleasures. It's not the same as you're existing without the pleasures. If you don't exist, there is nobody there who's being deprived.
Wow. How different is your theory or your philosophy from the existentialist movement, existentialism?
Well, existentialism is a very broad movement and includes a number of different thinkers with different views. There's some very optimistic existentialists, some which are more pessimistic. So I think one could characterize my inquiry as a kind of existentialist inquiry, and the questions that I'm asking is existentialist questions. But of course, I've got a particular take on those. I give a particular set of answers that may differ from other existentialists.
Mm. Prof, what has been the response to your book? Because, you know, you're dealing with some very controversial subjects that many people would find quite uncomfortable to delve into.
Indeed. Well, the reactions have been very mixed. First of all, there have been many people who've responded viscerally and quite angrily to what I've said, many of whom have confessed not even to having read the book. They've read some kind of blurb somewhere, or they've just heard the title, and they're responding instinctively with a great deal of anger. And many of them are leveling objections which, had they read the book, they will see have been considered and responded to. On the other hand, there have been people who've disagreed with me and who've attempted to argue very carefully and clearly for why they disagree with me, and it's been pleasant to engage in a philosophical discussion with those sorts of people. And then there has been a small minority of people who've written and said, gee, this sounds exactly right.
But I said earlier, and I don't know if this is a fair assessment of your work or your book, that it is leaning towards nihilism. I mean, if we talk about nihilism, are we saying that life has no purpose, that existence itself has no intrinsic value? What exactly is it?
Well, I would disagree with your characterization of my view as a nihilistic mm-hmm. view. Of course, it does depend on what one means by the word nihilism. But
sure.
if by nihilism one means a rejection of any kind of value, then my view is not nihilistic at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, my arguments proceed from values that almost everybody holds. So the premises of my argument are actually values that everybody holds. And what I try to show is that the implications of those values are ones which are quite radical and which most people don't recognize or realize.
And again, Prof, I really believe that all of us as human beings, we do have a choice. Even people who commit suicide, that is a choice to cease to exist. But for those of us who are already in existence, you and I, we already are living, we've come into being. What is the option? Do you continue to exist, or do we lament the fact that it is better not to have existed?
Well, I think there are a variety of ideas that you've raised there. First of all, I do want to clarify that I'm not recommending suicide.
No, of course not.
It,
no.
It may be true that some people's lives are so bad that they, on due reflection, decide that ending their lives is best. I don't think anybody should ever rush into a decision like that. It obviously has an impact not only on them, but on family members and those who are close to them. So it is an option, but I think it's an option that has to be very carefully considered, not rushed into, something that's discussed with other people. But my focus in the book is not on ending lives. It's on whether we should start lives. And my worry is that the optimistic view, the view that our lives are all just fine, that leads to the creation of new lives and new suffering. So while I think that while we're here, we should enjoy our lives, I'm very concerned about the creation of new centers of suffering, as it were. Every time one has a child, you're creating somebody who could suffer an immense amount. And the one thing that you can absolutely guarantee, one way you can absolutely guarantee that any child of yours will not suffer, is not to have that child.
Sure. So what are you saying, Prof? Are we overestimating the quality of our lives, the things that, for instance, bring us joy? We associate life, the beginning of life, a new baby, as a new beginning. So do we overestimate the quality of all those things?
Absolutely, and I think here it's quite important to get scientific, because there's actually very good and quite extensive psychological data on this phenomenon of human optimism and the inclination to view life as being very good. There are a number of well-documented, well-researched features of human psychology which demonstrate that we do overestimate the quality of our lives. And I don't think that this scientific evidence can just be readily ignored. So when people say to me, but I'm very happy to be alive and I think my life is just great, they can't say that without ignoring the scientific evidence.
0214460567 or 11883072. We are talking about life. It's a philosophical discussion, and we are exploring the question, are our lives much worse than we think? David Benatar, Professor David Benatar's book, Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence. Let's talk about it. What are your views on this one? We're not condemning anybody. We're not prescribing to people how they should view life, but we're exchanging ideas about what we make of this journey called life. Prof, just going back to the meaning of the word existence, I mean, it is a philosophically interesting notion, very familiar but elusive. And I say familiar because we are living life, we have a rhythm, but I also say elusive because it seems we do have a difficulty in saying exactly what existence is, or does it differ from one person to another?
I agree with you that existence is a philosophically complex word, and certainly when we apply it to human beings, there are interesting questions about what it means to exist. There's obviously a brute sort of biological sense in which we can exist, but then we could have the biological existence without, say, the conscious existence. And that's true of young embryos and fetuses, and it could be true of people who are brain dead but biologically alive. So those are interesting questions, and what I'm mainly interested in is really the sentient existence. But I also have some interest in the other kinds of existence.
Let's go straight to the lines. Is it Davy in Bryanston?
Yeah, it's me. Yes, hello.
Good morning.
Just a comment. I think the professor is making a logical sense, and I can't disagree with logic. But I think we as humans are genetically programmed to celebrate life and to be optimistic. So although your arguments, I think logically, it certainly hold water, I don't think it is really relevant, simply because we are differently programmed, and we are programmed to be optimistic, and we are programmed to have children and to make sure that our genes are going to the next generation and so on. So although it's very interesting and logically perhaps correct, it's really not relevant because we are a genetic being.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Prof?
Well, I agree that there are deep biological bases for our life drive and for our optimism. But I don't think it follows from that that what I say is not relevant. I think it's clearly going to follow that most people are going to want to reject what I say for deep biological reasons. But I don't think that what I say is irrelevant. After all, there are many other deep biologically based drives that people have, including drives towards aggression. Prejudice can have a biological explanation. But we don't think that these things are acceptable merely because they're biologically based. We need to evaluate our instincts, and we need to assess whether they're appropriate or inappropriate.
Let's go to Vimpy in Limbro Park. Hi.
Hello, Reedy. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just want to say that I cannot agree with the professor more. I feel life has not changed. It hasn't changed since my forefathers. 20 years ago, when my wife and I got married, we decided we're not going to have children because of the fact that life doesn't change. We are still doing things exactly the same way that our parents used to do things.
So hold on, Vimpy. Are you saying that this actually informed your decision not to have children?
Absolutely.
And you've been married 25 years.
Yes, and it's an absolute conscious decision that we made. If you look around you, people are suffering. Life is not getting better.
But have the moments of joy or finding your wife and whatever, does that not give more meaning to your existence or not?
100%. But there's also a matter of reason. And one has to look at life and say, can you really change it? Yes, I can, by not bringing another life onto this planet that goes through exactly the same mundane existence that we do from day to day.
Wow, Vimpy. Thank you.
You have to look at life in a very macabre way.
In a very macabre way?
Yes, because you know what? Look, I enjoy my life and I enjoy traveling and I'm fortunate enough with a lovely wife.
Yes.
But nothing changes.
Hmm.
You know, we have the ability to change our future.
Wow, okay.
May I come in?
Yes, please.
Well, I want to point out that there are a number of people, of course it's a small minority of all people, but there are a number of people like our caller who have consciously decided not to have children. And I would endorse the caller's sentiments. And I think we need to distinguish again between what gives us pleasure once we're already here, and I think those are important. It's important to have a better life rather than a worse life once you're here. But that's a separate question from whether starting a life is a good thing. Because whenever you start a life, you're creating a center of suffering. You're creating a being that can suffer and will suffer a great deal. Whatever pleasures that being has, that will mitigate in some way the pains, but the pain that you're creating is completely unnecessary.
I guess, Prof, I mean, as you're saying this, I'm just thinking, isn't there a certain... What's the word I'm looking for? A certain dichotomy that surrounds our existence. We're here one moment and gone the next. You are alive and dead the next. You live, you die. Death is scary, but life can be amazing.
It can be. There are people who enjoy it, but I don't think that's the relevant question. I think the relevant question is, once you consider the two alternatives of never existing or coming into existence, it seems to me that there are certain advantages. There are certain advantages to never coming into existence that don't apply in the other direction.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I hear you completely. Let's go to Sarah in Four Ways. Hi,
Reedy. Hi. Good morning, and good morning to Professor Benatar. Reedy, when I heard your topic this morning, I got so excited because I thought to myself, here is a man, the only man I've ever heard of, speaking my language. Really, my mother passed away recently, and it really got me questioning the meaning of life. And if one looks at the damage that mankind has created in terms of the planet, the environment, although I haven't read Professor Benatar's book, and I most certainly would love to read it and will make sure I do read it, and I don't know how he's approaching the subject, just what I've heard on the radio makes a whole lot of sense to me.
All right. Thank you very much. That's Sarah in Four Ways. And we go to Peter in Bryanston. Thanks for your patience. You've been holding on for so long. Welcome.
Thank you, Reedy. And morning, Prof.
Good morning.
I want to support that concept of choosing not to have children. By the time I was 23, I knew that I would never have children and took steps to ensure that I would never have children.
Why?
Because at that time, Reedy, I thought I don't want to have children. You know, and I couldn't place it. It wasn't because the world's bad. The world is. You know, the world we live in today might not be nice, but it is like that. And it wasn't until I was 38 years old that I actually recognized what it was. And I was on a workshop, and I actually said to the person I was working with, representing the energy of my father, that, you know, I'd spent my whole life trying not to be like you were, down to the point of depriving myself of having children, so that I could never be a father like you were to me. All right? And then that whole thing, and it just kind of made sense. You know, I'm not qualified to be a father. In my opinion, I'm not qualified to be a father. Was not at that time.
And you've never regretted...
You've been able to take that decision to say, no, I don't want to be a father because I'm not qualified to do that. And so as a result of that, no, I haven't brought any new beings into existence.
And you've never regretted that, Peter?
No, because I've had my whole life to be able to look at it and say, how do I make the best of what I have in my life? Despite the world being a bad place and all the other things you might say about it.
Yeah, okay. That's Peter and Bryanston. Prof, I'm just thinking, you know, people who would overestimate the quality of life, or your motivational speakers, preachers, and many other people who encourage people to be positive, reach for your dreams, you know, that kind of language. If we're arguing that all our lives are very bad and generally much worse than we think, but isn't the counter argument that it's because of things that mankind have done that our lives are much worse than we think? So if we live, we have an opportunity to change all of that.
Well, I certainly think that humans have contributed their fair share of misery to the planet.
I think so.
Their fair share of misery to the planet. But I think that even if we did everything right, nature is still constructed in such a way that there's going to be an immense amount of suffering. It's just unavoidable. It's written so deeply into the structure of sentient life that it's unavoidable. We can minimize it or maximize it, and I certainly think we should minimize the amount of pain that there is, but we can't come even close to eliminating it all.
Let's go to Karen, and David Klatso is also on the line from Rondebosch. We'll talk to you in just a moment. Karen in Orange Grove, hi.
Hi. I found the subject absolutely fascinating. And while I do think that there probably should be fewer humans on the planet, I just wanted to refer to the book Conversations with God. I don't know if you've ever read it, where said that God could only experience existence having a body. So whatever you experience in your life is part of God experienced existence, and you've got to experience existence. So whatever it is, whether it's suffering, accidents, pain, wonderful things, abundance, all of those kind of things are just part of the experience. So it's your experience of existence. So everyone has to experience things and experience them to their fullest to understand the point of existing at all.
Are you better off, though, having experienced all those things?
I don't think it's a point of being better off. It's a point of the fact that you have to experience it.
Why?
Because God needed to experience it. The beginning of the universe that was nothingness had to experience the fact that it existed, and the only way that it could ever experience what it existed, that it existence at all, was through being solid, being existing, being,
but
being a body,
got,
being
you've,
something.
But you've got to believe in God for you to take that kind of approach,
even,
isn't it?
I mean, God is... I'm not talking about God as father the figure, kind of religious figure. I'm talking about that existence that was nothingness before there was existence.
Okay.
Well,
Prof?
That's where I think there's some confusion. I think it's a common confusion because before anybody comes into existence, they aren't. And so there is nobody there who needs to experience anything. There's nobody there who needs to be brought into existence so as to obtain certain benefits or so as to understand anything better.
Just to die again after all of that.
Exactly.
All right, interesting. Let's go to David Klatso in Rondebosch. Good morning to you.
Hello, Rudy.
Hi.
Hello, David.
Morning.
I enjoy the thought of your conversation as much as I enjoyed your inaugural lecture, and I must say that it is a very courageous sort of concept to tackle like this, particularly publicly. But and I'm very pleased that your father didn't have the same views, David. However, what I would like to say is this, is that pleasure and pain are really two sides of the same coin. And then I think that it's very difficult for me to conceive of one without the other. If life were one unending orgasm, I have no doubt that you'd be begging for it to stop. And I think that quite often the vicissitudes of life create the strength which creates an enjoyment in the rest of life. And I think that it might be just a little negative to see life in terms of a purely selfish concept of am I going to get anything out of it, or is life mundane, or whatever. Life is not mundane. Life, as far as I'm concerned, with all the pleasures and with all the pain of having existed, has really created a sense of unending enjoyment for me overall, if I looked at it.
It's what I was talking
about. Dark moments, but there have been some incredibly wonderful moments.
It's exactly what I was talking about, David, the dichotomy surrounding our existence, the joy and the pain of it all.
Absolutely. There are two sides, in my view. I don't think you can ever have only joy without experiencing pain. I think that the two have to be coexisted.
But are you not better off not having experienced that pain? I guess that's what it is.
I think ultimately, if you look at it from an individual point of view, clearly, but if you look at it from a general point of view of the organism as a whole, I think that it's a wonderful theoretical situation, but it could obviously never exist, because then mankind as we know it would come to an end.
That's David Klatso. Yes, Prof?
There are many ideas that have been raised. First of all, it wasn't me who said that our lives are mundane. I think it was one of the callers. So my argument's not based on that premise. Secondly, I'm not sure that pain and pleasure are two sides of the same coin. I think that it is possible, firstly, to have pain without pleasure. There's some lives that are filled with unmitigated pain. There's just no pleasure. They don't last long enough for there to be any pleasure, and they're just painful. The other point that Dr. Klatso made was that we can't have only pleasures. But that's exactly my point, is that given the nature of life, you can't live without having pain. And I think that pain is all gratuitous. He also suggests that this could never be, because it would mean that there are no more humans. But the sad news, presumably for him, for me, the good news, is that there will come a time when there are no more humans on the planet. Our species is going to go the route of every other species. We don't know when it's going to end. We don't know if it's going to be sooner or later. But one thing I know for absolute sure is that the later it happens, the more suffering there's going to be.
I want us to get into a longer discussion about that. It sounds to me that you hope one day, Prof, that all humans and other animals must just go extinct.
Well, of course, there are different ways of going extinct. I'm not recommending killing anybody or any animal. I don't want anybody to be killed off. But I think it would be better, all things considered, if we died off. And that is, in other words, if we didn't replace the current humans with new humans.
Let's take a break. We'll take more of your calls in a moment.
Talk Radio.
Just to give you an idea of Professor David Benatar's book, he is the head of philosophy department at the University of Cape Town. The book is called Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence. In chapter 3, for example, he defends the idea that even the best lives are not only much worse than people think ordinarily, but also very bad in themselves. He argues by appealing to empirical research that people's self-assessments of the quality of their lives is unreliable. Let's say self-assessment is unreliable. So the way we assess our lives, the quality thereof, is unreliable. And in this chapter, he goes on to argue that the quality of human life is judged to be bad according to all three of the most common views of quality of life: hedonistic view, the desire fulfillment view, and the objectivist view. The rest of the book defends a number of important practical implications of his thesis. So you may want to grab a copy so we can grapple with all of these. Let's go to David in Kyalami. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, there are two points I want to make. You know, the one is sort of one from mindfulness, that a lot of wisdom comes through working through things that may be unpleasant. But the more important one comes down to, it's the whole question of consciousness. And maybe I can give you the example of two cats that I had, one my uncle had, and it was from you, you know, when it was about a year old, it was in an accident, a dog bit it, it was paralyzed from the waist down. We put it on a little trolley, and it was quite happy, purring, everything. One of my cats got blinded, and within 2 days, he was jumping around the place. So I think a lot of our conception of what is pain or displeasure comes from our consciousness of it.
Yeah.
You know, so similarly, you know, the professor is working in an area with from a scientific milieu, or a certain position of consciousness that perceives certain things to be painful or unpleasant and others not. And to a large extent, I think it's a human consciousness and awareness of what is pain, what is displeasure, that creates a lot of that, especially in a psychological level.
Hmm.
So, you know, to my mind, if somebody has a psychological appreciation of my life being pleasant or there being worthwhile things in my life, then the factor that makes that pleasant for the person. You know, I don't know that we can really compare so-called epistemological or empirical proofs to say that you're wrong. Mm-hmm. You think your life is pleasant, but it actually isn't pleasant.
Okay, that's David and Kailami. Lovely call. Prof, I'll tell you what, can I take a few more calls and then
sure.
we can respond to everyone all together as well as wrap
sure.
up the people who've been holding on for so long. Sipo in Midrand, hi.
Hi, the name is Steph, actually, Rudy. I understand the concerns that have been raised about our general quality of life, but the statement that when you start a new life, you're actually starting a new center of suffering, I don't agree with. We can't really say now we're going to discourage starting a new life because of the possibility of suffering. I'm of the opinion that the value of life is actually realized in the meaning of life. So the sooner you find the meaning of your life, the sooner you can actually realize the value. And how much suffering was incurred in that lifetime or that existence
mm-hmm.
becomes really trivial.
Okay, that's Sipo in Midrand. Ligao in Edenvale, hi.
Hello, I wanted to find out from the professor what criteria he's using to determine how worse our lives are, because I'm thinking there are some things that you can experience in life that can put you in a position whereby you become oblivious to the negative things that you experience in life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's clear.
Okay, Prof?
Okay, well, that question and the first one are actually connected. The criteria that I'm using are actually three different criteria, because they're three different ways in which philosophers have assessed quality of life. The one is based on how much pleasure there is in a life. The one is on the extent to which one's desires are fulfilled. And the third one is the extent to which one's life meets certain objective conditions. And what I try to do is I try to step through each of those different theories and show how, irrespective of which of those views you take, our lives are nonetheless very bad. Now, to connect that to the first questioner, he's quite correct that if you have an optimistic view on life and you view your pains in a certain way, that there's an extent to which they're made less bad than they otherwise would be. But what he's actually describing is a phenomenon that's known as adaptation. And what that
mm-hmm.
means is that something bad happens to you actually adjust to it, and you now no longer expect to have anything better than that. And that means that a lot of the bad things in our lives, we actually overlook because we've adapted to them. There's very good evidence, for example, that people who are disabled in accidents, at first, their self-assessment of the quality of their life dips. They think their lives have now become much worse. But they adapt to the new condition very often, and then they return to the sort of baseline view of how good their life is afterwards.
Mm.
And this applies to many, many bad things that happen to people. So if you look at how their lives are actually going, it's not very good, but they've adapted it in such a way that they think it's better than it really is.
You're listening to Reedy Direko.
Some SMSs very quickly. This life is spirit, continues into another life. Craig says there's life drive and a death drive. Is day and night, both are valid. We must try to have harmony between the two. A very good discussion. Thanks. Reedy, the professor is right. There is futility in existence. We're better off if we don't experience some of this pain. One says, I swear I've never heard such an amount of hogwash. That's Innocent in Protea Glen. Regarding your last caller, how many millions must die of hunger before God gets enough of the experience? I like the fact that we are grappling with, geez, I use the word grappling, so every second person is using grappling. I actually hate it. But anyway, Professor, you know, I must be honest. I'm actually surprised at the number of people who have sent emails and calls in support of your argument. I mean, is this the sign of the times? I don't know. I actually thought that your views were so controversial that many people will be slamming you. There are some who are critical, and that's fine. All of them should articulate their views. But I'm taken aback by the number of people who are saying, actually, it's true.
I must say I'm a little surprised too how many people have called in favour. I think there may be an explanation for that. It might be that these sorts of views are so rarely discussed in public and they so frowned upon that this opportunity on the radio to talk about them has brought people out of their shell and enabled them to speak about ideas that ordinarily are taboo.
And I won't forget that. You're saying those who never exist cannot be deprived.
Exactly.
Thank you. Yes, you wanted to say something.
I wanted to respond to one of the earlier callers who said that he disagreed that when we create a new being, a new human being, we're creating a new center of suffering. He said we shouldn't be worried about a mere possibility of suffering. But in fact, it's absolutely guaranteed
it
that
is
every
a guarantee.
Person that we bring into existence will suffer in some or other way.
Hmm.
And another call of yours spoke about the meaning of life. And I would just say that for your life to have meaning, of course, you have to have a life. And so it's not problematic if those who never exist don't have any meanings in their lives because they don't have any lives.
All right, Professor, I really have loved chatting to you and I'm sure we'll do so again. Good luck with the book, eh?
Thanks very much. Nice to chat to you and your callers.
Thank you so very much. And those of you who are SMSing, the book is called Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence by Professor David Benatar.